Welcome to the Eurovision Travel Guide. In this new monthly series, we're going to be exploring a country in the Eurovision Song Contest, learning about some of their entries, their national selection methods, and some other noteworthy points. The first country we're going to be taking a look at is Israel. In this week's episode of ESC 101, join me in learning more about Eurovision's first non-European country to join the contest. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to ESC 101, your home of Eurovision history and obscurity. This is the podcast where we take a look at the Eurovision Song Contest throughout the years to uncover the story behind the world's largest international televised music competition. Welcome to episode 4. My name is Alexander, and let's jump right into Israel's history at the Eurovision Song Contest. So, normally I would love to dive into a country's history and culture, exploring the rich stories that helped shape their presence at the Eurovision Song Contest. However, there's a lot of people out there, and there's some countries out there that might not exactly acknowledge the existence of Israel. If you know anything about Israeli history, there's a mind-boggling amount of tension between various people groups, lots of colonial irresponsibility on the part of European empires, lots of tribes and cultures moving in and out of the region, and of course, current conflicts which some people support, others don't. It's kind of a huge mess that I really don't want to get into, otherwise I will offend someone by saying something even in passing. So in this episode, I am focusing solely on Israel's participation in the scope of the Eurovision Song Contest as recognized by the European Broadcasting Union and the broadcasters of Israel who are members of the EBU. And I'm also not going to be exploring every single entry that Israel has ever sent, otherwise this would turn into a several hour long opinion rant. So if you would like to hear some opinions on the Israeli entries themselves, you can check out the Eurovision Forever project that's hosted on the 12 podcast, where they rate every single entry in the Eurovision Song Contest from 1956 to 2022, and that includes all the Israeli entries. So with that being said, let's go ahead and dive into Israel at the Eurovision Song Contest. So to begin this episode, let's address the age-old question of why Israel's even allowed into the Eurovision Song Contest. Lots of people ask this sort of question saying, oh, Israel's not even part of Europe. Why are they in Eurovision? There's nothing European about Israel, at least geographically speaking. The short answer is they're basically part of the European broadcasting area that allows membership into the EBU. So a little bit of historical context. The Israel Broadcasting Authority, also known as the IBA, first joined the EBU in 1957. The EBU allows any countries that are either within the European broadcasting area or a member of the Council of Europe, if they lay physically outside of those boundaries, to join. And the European broadcasting area basically covers all of the European continent, along with North Africa and the northern parts of the Middle East. So countries like Iraq, Syria, and Saudi Arabia could theoretically join the EBU if they wanted to. And the story behind the European broadcasting area and sort of the older parts of the EBU deserve its own episode. And basically, the European broadcasting area covers the continent plus like the Mediterranean Sea and the countries that kind of surround it, because like broadcast waves would naturally go over the sea into North Africa. So the European broadcasting area includes those regions, just to like add additional countries into the European Broadcasting Union's sphere of broadcasting and cooperation. And of course, Israel isn't the only country to join the Eurovision Song Contest that's outside of Europe. Of course, you have Morocco, who joined the one time in 1980. And you have Australia that joined in 2015. They're kind of a way different category of why they're in the contest, which of course will be part of its own Eurovision Travel Guide episode. So that's basically why Israel is allowed to be part of the contest because it's part of the European Broadcasting Area. It's a member of the EBU and thus has a right to participate in all EBU activities. So Israel has participated 45 times, according to the EBU. 46, if you count 1996's pre-qualification audio-only semifinal. I don't know if you want to call it a semifinal, because it didn't make it in 96. So it technically did not participate in 96. I think it does. I think the EBU is totally wrong on that. I think Israel sent a song. They intended to compete. They just didn't make it to the grand final. And so they just didn't appear on the night. But I still think they participated. So 46 times in my book, but 45 according to the EBU. They missed out on 5 contests, or only 4 if you don't count 1996. They debuted in 1973, having finished in the top 10 on 21 occasions. So 21 out of 45 is actually really good. That's almost like half their participation is in the top 10, which I think is amazing. They finished top 5 on 12 occasions. They earned the bronze podium spot in 1991 and 2023. Really good job. They earned the silver podium in 1982 and 1983, and they ended up winning the contest 4 times in 1978, 79, 98, and 2018. Israel has never come last in the grand final or any semifinal that it's been in, and that is a huge accomplishment. I think for any country to not come last in the grand final or any semifinal, I think is a huge accomplishment. And this includes 1996, where they failed to qualify from the pre-audio round. But they also have failed to qualify from semifinals 7 times, or 8 times if you count 1996. Kind of a bit of a mixed bag, especially in recent years. And we'll get into that when we get into the 2010s. But suffice to say, Israel's done a pretty good job. Israel has sent its entries mostly in either the Hebrew or the English language, depending on when the language laws were in place. Their 2007 entry contained some French lyrics, and their 2009 entry contained some Arabic. In 2020, they planned on featuring the song in English and Amharic, which is an Ethiopian Semitic language. But of course, the 2020 contest was canceled, and that doesn't count towards participation. There are 11 people that have represented Israel at the Eurovision Song Contest more than once, either as a solo artist, a backing singer, or a member of a group. Listed in order of their first appearance on the Eurovision stage, we have, and my apologies for any names that I'm about to mispronounce, Ilanit, solo artist in 1973 and 1977, Yardena Arazi, member of the group Chocolade Menta Mastic in 1976 and solo artist in 1988. Izar Cohen, singing with the Alpha Beta in 1978 and a solo artist in 1985. Reuven Gvertz, member of the group Milk and Honey in 1979 and a backing singer in 1986 and 1988. Yehuda Tamir, member of the group Milk and Honey in 1979 and a backing singer in 1988. Shlomo Maman, backing singer in 1982 and 1983. Sima Amiel, backing singer in 1983 and 1986. Dana International, a solo artist in 1998 and 2011. Eddie Butler, member of the group Eden in 1999 and a solo artist in 2006. Ortal Ofek, backing singer in 2002 and 2006, and Imri Ziv, backing singer in 2015 and 16, and a solo artist in 2017. If I have forgotten anybody, I do apologize for missing them, but that is the list of returning artists that I was able to put together. Israel was the second country to have a female conductor, doing so in their debut year. And Israel's artists represent a wide variety of acts, from solo artists to groups. Israel has hosted the contest 3 times, 1979, 1999, and 2019. Perhaps they'll be the next hosts in 2039. So, to start with Israel's debut in 1973, we have to go back 1 year to 1972 to learn about how Israel even became eligible to enter the contest. there was an interview done by Sagi Ben-Non for NRG, where Ilanit, who we mentioned earlier, was Israel's first Eurovision performer, was interviewed about her time at Eurovision. In 1972, Ilanit was recording music in Germany. Her producers approached her and her music team with an offer to represent Germany in the Eurovision Song Contest. Ilanit had known about the contest and its potential to broadcast culture across multiple music markets, and she was interested in competing, but she wanted to check the rules of the EBU to see if Israel could somehow compete. She discovered that Israel was a member of the EBU because of the broadcaster's membership in the country lying within the European broadcasting area, and thus they were eligible to compete. But by the time that she negotiated with the IBA to join Eurovision in 1972, the submission period was closed. So Ilanit decided to focus her efforts for the 1973 contest, and thus she was able to enter her song for that year, coming fourth place, getting 97 points. And this was an era where juries had to give a minimum score of 1, so it was not possible to get a null point in 1973. Israel's debut in 1973 came with some security issues after the Munich massacre the year before, which is a terrorist attack during the Summer Olympics where 6 Israeli coaches and 5 Israeli athletes, along with other individuals, were killed in the attack. Security officials increased their protocols, and audience members at the 1973 Eurovision Song Contest were warned not to stand during the show or make sudden movements at the risk of being shot by security, which I have to admit is a pretty scary thought to have, where it's like you're sitting in the audience and you're really excited for an entry, but you're told not to make sudden movements, otherwise you might be shot. And especially with the previous episode that we just did about the stage invaders in 1964, I imagine that there would have been some tensions in security, especially with a higher threat of attack given the Munich massacre the year before. There is also a rumor that Ilanit wore a bulletproof vest during her performance underneath her costume as an extra precaution, but in a 2007 interview with Marcus Kleier of ESC Today, Ilanit confirmed that it was just a story and she actually didn't wear one. She was quoted as saying, "We had a lot of guards around us. Everyone who went into the concert hall was searched and women's bags were checked. People were not used to it. There was a story that I had a bulletproof vest under my dress for security, but it was not true. It was just a story." And Eurovision Song Contests today do have security measures. There's usually metal detectors and bags are searched. That was the experience that I had when I attended Eurovision in Lisbon. We were in line. There was a security checkpoint that we went through to make sure our tickets were valid, to put us through security, metal detectors, and to have our bags searched. So this has kind of become a common occurrence today, but I guess back in 1973, they didn't really have that level of security that was normalized, but it seemed that people were good with it as long as it keeps the contest secure. Israel initially had pretty good success in its first 15 appearances, so covering from 1973 to 1989. Israel managed to get in the top 10 on 11 occasions, so 11 out of 15 in the top 10 is pretty good, with 2 second places and 2 wins back-to-back. From 1973 to 1977, Israel used internal selections to choose their entries. So I guess they hadn't gotten the whole national final thing down pat yet. So I guess they went with internal selections and it seemed pretty good. Their first national final was the Israel Song Festival, which was used in 1978 and 1979. And of course, if you know 1978 and 1979, you know that they won both times. So clearly this was a really good idea. The Israel Song Festival was actually directly inspired from Italy's San Remo Music Festival. So an Israeli producer was on vacation in Rome in 1959, so this was like way before Israel joined the contest. And this producer saw people celebrating Domenico Modugno's victory that year. The producer approached the IBA and, with support of the Israeli Prime Minister at the time, held the first Israel Song Festival in 1960. Of course, this hadn't had any connection to the Eurovision Song Contest, rather they just ran the Israel Song Festival as its own thing. It had a bit of an unstable tenure, being cancelled a number of times due to low ratings, but eventually the Israel Song Festival was used as the national pre-selection for the Eurovision Song Contest. And of course, they ended up winning in 1978 and 79. Izar Cohen and the Alpha Beta with the song Abani B in 1978, and Milk and Honey with the song Hallelujah. Israel technically became the third country to win twice in a row, or technically the second country if you don't count Spain's double win in 1968 and 69 due to the four-way tie fiasco thing. That topic is definitely being covered in a future episode because that boggles my mind to no end. On top of being a double winner, Israel is also the only country to have won the Eurovision Song Contest and not return the next year to defend its title. This occurred in 1980. With winning back-to-back, Israel found that it could not financially afford to host the contest. And back in those days, it wasn't uncommon for countries to have that problem, so the Netherlands agreed to host the contest instead. Oddly enough, the Netherlands came 12th in 1979, with Spain being the runner-up, but Spain didn't want to host it, the UK didn't want to host it, and in fact, the 1980 contest almost got cancelled. Again, that's another episode topic for another time. But the short version is the Netherlands hosted, and we went to The Hague in the Netherlands to celebrate the 25th Eurovision Song Contest. So very good on the Netherlands. The EBU basically scheduled the contest to take place on Israel's Memorial Day, forcing Israel to withdraw from the contest. And Israel also withdrew in 1984 and 1997 due to those same reasons. The EBU has to juggle dates when coordinating multiple countries, and I guess they had to pick the least hated option. So it's a bit of a shame that Israel didn't come to the Eurovision Song Contest in 1980 to defend its title, but I guess that's just the way it works. When Israel returned in 1981, they decided to change their national selection process. I don't know why they would mess with the success formula, considering that they won twice with the Israel Song Festival, but I guess they decided to mess with that success, and it led to the creation of Kadam Eurovision, translated as pre-Eurovision or simply known as Kadam. Kadam ran from 1981 to 1987. In 1988, they suspended the usual format of Kadam due to cost-cutting measures, and Israel decided to internally select the artist, and instead used a different format of Kadam hosted at the IBA studios in Jerusalem to select the song. In 1989, Israel brought back Kadam to select their entry in full, but in 1990, they went back to an internal selection. Kadam was again brought back in 1991, selecting their entries for Eurovision until Israel's withdrawal in 1997. Israel's results in the 1990s were a bit more fluctuated compared to the first 15 years of Israel's participation. They got into the top 10 on 5 occasions in the 90s with a win in 98, but they were relegated in 1994. Relegated meaning that they were forced out of the contest due to poor performances the previous year. The whole nonsense of relegation will definitely be covered in a future episode. There is a lot of future episode titles, so definitely stay tuned to learn about all these different topics that I'm talking about, because there's going to be a lot. They failed to qualify in 1996, as mentioned a bajillion times at this point, and they were below the top 10 on 2 different occasions. The 1996 pre-qualification round was a bit of a mess. The EBU doesn't count that as a participation, but I do, as I mentioned earlier. It just doesn't feel right to not include countries that put in an actual song and participated in the process of being in Eurovision. If they were relegated, then they wouldn't send a song. That clearly doesn't count as a participation, but in 1996, Israel didn't make it through the semi-final process, but they were still in the show. And after this failure in 1996, Israel withdrew in 1997. This was due to the aforementioned scheduling issue around their Memorial Day. Of course, there are probably some other good reasons why they would withdraw, and so they decided to take a year off, and they returned the following year. And thank goodness they returned the following year round, because they ended up winning in 1998. However, in 1998, Israel decided to put a pause on Kadam and opted instead for internal selections until the year 2000. This seemed like a pretty good idea with Donna International's win in 1998 and their fairly decent home entry in 1999. But then the year 2000 happened, and when Israel selected the group Ping Pong, that was probably one of the worst mistakes they ever made in their broadcasting careers. They ended up disavowing their entrant following their little stunt on the stage, and they eventually realized that maybe they shouldn't be picking entrants. They probably got a little too overconfident in their selection abilities after their win in 98, and so they decided to smarten up and go back to a national final selection. But this came a little bit too late, as Israel's results continued to decline in the 2000s, only coming in the top 10 on two occasions and failing to qualify from the semifinals twice. Israel kind of had a bit of an identity crisis in their national selection programs, and they literally just kept going back and forth between Kadam and internal selections to pick their entrants, sometimes using both methods by internally selecting the artists, but using Kadam to pick the song. I would run through year by year what national selections they use, but that would take too long and be a waste of everyone's time, so I'm not going to bother talking about it, but just know that they went back and forth and eventually they would stabilize by realizing that their going back and forth wasn't working very well. The first half of the 2010s was Israel's worst performance in Eurovision by far, failing to qualify from 2011 to 2014. And by 2014, Israel was pretty fed up with their poor results and shut down Kadam permanently. And so Israel in 2015 decided to use a new Israeli TV series called HaKohav Haba, translated to The Next Star, to select their Eurovision entrant. However, the song would be an internal choice from 2015 to 2020, except for 2016, with the show picking both the artist and the song. Contestants would perform various songs to gather votes from judges and audience members, and this seemed like a good choice for Israel, as the winner of HaKohav Haba in the first year of being the Eurovision selection show ended up being Hadav Gudej. He reached the top 10 with the song Golden Boy, which remains an iconic party anthem in Eurovision circles to this day. But Israel's performance since 2015 have been fairly erratic, moving from very good, very decent, to bottom five. And the peak of the drama regarding Israel's participation occurred in 2017, when the Israeli Broadcasting Authority, which was the national broadcaster that held the rights to represent Israel in the Eurovision Song Contest, had shut down. It actually shut down the very night of the contest that year, with the Joy spokesman Ofer Nachshon giving a tearful goodbye as he believed it was Israel's final year in the Eurovision Song Contest. After the IBA finished broadcasting the Eurovision Song Contest that year, the station would shut down for good. But as you know, that isn't the end of Israel's participation, because there was a public broadcaster called the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation, also known as KAN, that was taking the position to become the new national broadcaster for Israel, applying for EBU membership. After the 2017 contest, the EBU signed an agreement allowing KAN to participate in the EBU events like the Eurovision Song Contest on a provisional basis until the membership process was finalized. And thank goodness the EBU did that, because the following year, Israel ended up winning with Netta and the song Toy, hosting the last consecutive Eurovision Song Contest in 2019 before the first and to date only cancellation of Eurovision in 2020. Some controversy arose in 2018 after Netta's win over the structure of KAN. The Israeli government eventually agreed to the EBU stipulations, and in December 2018, the EBU approved the membership application, allowing Israel to properly host the contest in Tel Aviv in 2019 under KAN. In 2020, Eden Len won HaKohav Haba, but rather than the internally selected song, Israel decided to use a second show to select the song with public input. They used the show Hashir Haba Eurovision, and Eden was given four songs and ended up with the song Fekir Libi. Of course, Eurovision 2020 was canceled due to the pandemic, so Israel decided to internally select Eden to represent Israel in 2021. Her song selection was selected through a different national selection from 2020, and this show was called Hashir Shelanu Eurovision, where the public submitted songs, and out of 220 submissions, 9 songs ended up being chosen to compete. There were 2 rounds, and the song Set Me Free was chosen by an extremely wide margin. Fun fact, Ida Nalén ended up breaking the record for the highest note sung on the Eurovision stage, hitting a B6 whistle note. And for anybody that knows anything about music, this is an octave higher than the notes on the top of a standard music staff, so quite high. In 2022, Israel decided to use X Factor as its method of selecting its Eurovision entrant, of course, ruining its only chances of actually doing decently at the Eurovision Song Contest. It seems like Israel likes to meddle when they really shouldn't be. The X Factor took the top four candidates and gave them songs to sing and be voted on by the public. But of course, after Israel's non-qualification that year, what a big surprise, they came to the realization that idea was dumb and decided to use an internal selection for 2023. And participation for 2024 has already been confirmed, with Israel planning to go back to using HaKohav Haba as their selection method, hopefully recapturing some of the success founded in 2015 and 2018. Overall, Israel has produced some entertaining entries, especially ones that highlight Israeli culture using sounds that resonate with the region. Some of my favorite entries from Israel include 1973 and 74, 1978, 1982, 85, 1991, 98, 2015, 2018, and 2021. Looking at the voting system running from 1975 to 2015, this is the system that uses the singular 12-point system. When Israel was in the grand final, Israel's top point givers included France, where they gave 152 points across the span of 1975 to 2015. Finland gave the second most points to Israel with 128 points total, and Switzerland gave the third most points with 125 points. This is quite a wide margin of countries, and it doesn't look like Israel has particular countries that it favors, so that's kind of a good thing, I guess. And overall, from 1975 to 2015, Israel received 2,227 points, which is a pretty decent amount of points. What's really fascinating about this, though, is that from 1975 to 2015 in the grand final, Israel received points from every single participating country except for two. It didn't get any points from Morocco because Israel didn't participate at all. And Serbia and Montenegro, who only had two contests with Israel in the grand final and just, I guess, decided not to give them points that year. And then Serbia and Montenegro split into two separate countries. And so Serbia and Montenegro have given Israel points of some kind up until the 2015 period. It's kind of difficult to get points from every single country that has participated in Eurovision, but Israel comes extremely close. Looking at the points that Israel gives from 1975 to 2015, the most points that it gave to a country was the UK with 138 points, Sweden with 135 points, and France with 115. And in terms of the winning entries for each year that Israel was a participant, Israel gave 2,088 points over its participation, giving an average of about 8.39 points to the winning song in contest that they voted in. So I'd say Israel have a pretty decent chance of pointing out the winner in their scoring, at least in this period. So it's a country definitely to keep an eye on. It's fascinating to see Eurovision's boundaries expand beyond the physical borders of the European continent. It shows that there are countries which share a space with Europe and have the same desire to showcase their culture in a friendly and open competition. And while Israel as a country is no stranger to controversy, even in the Eurovision sphere, it provides an extra perspective into what Eurovision is, as a competition not defined necessarily by physical borders, but rather shared cultures in a shared geographical space. And now that we've gone through the history of Israel in the Eurovision Song Contest, let's turn to a news story which covers a country which sadly won't ever be featured in the Eurovision Travel Guide. It's time for the Eurovision Report. Liechtenstein's broadcaster 1FL TV has confirmed that it will not be pursuing EBU membership in time to debut at the Eurovision Song Contest in 2024. Efforts to join the EBU came to a halt around 4 years ago after the death of the broadcaster's director, Mr. Peter Kobel. The efforts of Mr. Kobel have been challenged by a lack of support from the government of Liechtenstein, as well as solving the financial constraint of EBU membership, in addition to the costs of participating in the Eurovision Song Contest. Liechtenstein unfortunately shows no signs of joining the EBU anytime soon, and it will be a while before we even can consider Liechtenstein joining the contest. This is reported by Sanjay Jandani of ESC Today. Danny Estrin, the lead vocalist of the band Voyager, who represented Australia at the 2023 Eurovision Song Contest, has revealed that he has been diagnosed with cancer. Details on his condition are being kept private at this time, but we do know that he is getting the best treatment he can get. This diagnosis has led to the postponement of the European tour to next year, and their final show for the time being will take place at the America's Cup event in Fremantle, Western Australia, on Sunday, September 24th. Danny is asking for respect on his privacy during this time. This was reported by Danny Estrin's Instagram page. This has been the Eurovision Report. And now it's time for this week's Song of the Week. This is the part of the show where I share a Eurovision entry that I find entertaining, cool, interesting, or perhaps painful to listen to or historically noteworthy. One of these days I should pick an entry that I dislike, but this week it's another entry that I love. And of course, with this episode being part of the Eurovision Travel Guide, I've selected an entry from the country that we've just explored. So let's take a look at which Israeli entry I chose for this week's Song of the Week. This week's Song of the Week is the Israeli entry from 1985, Ole Ole, sung by Yizhar Cohen. Composer Kobi Osharat, lyricist Hamutal Ben-Ziv, and conducted by Kobi Osharat. It placed 5th in 1985 with 93 points. It got 12 points from France, 10 points from Norway, 8 points from Ireland and Spain, and other points awarded by 11 other countries. This song is a really fun party song featuring backing dancers dressed in colors which I can only describe as Power Rangers, the show where each character has a very distinct color in their uniform, and each dancer is in a specific color and synchronizes their movements with each other. And it is simply an amazing show. A lot of them actually look into the camera directly, and it's sometimes a bit scary because their faces are very, like, forced smiles, forced, like, look at me, I'm being entertaining, and sometimes it's a bit intense. And sadly, one of the backing dancers' microphone was turned up too high, and you can hear her kind of screeching during the first chorus. She's, like, really excited, and he's like, I'm gonna sing the chorus really loudly, and then it happens, and it sounds really bad. If you watch the woman on the left, that's the one that screeches quite loudly in the turquoise dress. And if you look closely, you can see the little black dot between her chest where the dress forms the bottom of the V. That's where the microphone is, and if you watch throughout the performance, you can see that the microphone kind of drops slowly down the dress because you realize that the microphone got unclipped from the dress and kind of keeps dropping down, and you can see the microphone dangling around. I listened closely to the audio in some of the remastered show clips, and I noticed that there was some small clinking involved because her belt kind of has these, like, little baubles attached. And it's almost as if the microphone's hitting the bauble. So I think you can still hear the microphone hitting the belt on her dress. And I'm thinking to myself, if this woman's microphone's way too loud and you can see it, like, on the soundboard, at least I'm assuming you can see it on the soundboard. I don't know what kind of system they were using in Sweden, but normally on a soundboard, you can see when a microphone, like, peaks and has these, like, awful sounds. I would have, like, turned off that microphone instantly just to, like, not have that clipping sound. And they should have had a television camera to say, this woman's microphone is dangling, let's just turn it off. But I don't think they ever did. She eventually does notice that her microphone is dangling around, like, near towards the end. And she does stuff the microphone back into her dress and feels a lot more flexible when it comes to, like, the end of the performance. Because she's like, oh, I have to put this microphone away. Okay, now I can, like, kind of do a full dance. And poor microphone balancing aside, this is actually a solid performance by Ezer Cohen, and the orchestra really brings the song to life. The studio version I don't like listening to because it sounds quite flat, and the orchestra, specifically with the strings and the brass section, truly brings that like a third dimension to the song that I think is missing in the studio track. Focusing on the instrumental, there's a lot going on, and it brings this like beautiful extra depth to the song that I don't get in the studio version, so I prefer listening to this live. It is a solid song that is simply a wonderful performance by Ezer Cohen. If it had competed in 1983, it probably would have won. Or at least it would probably should have won in my eyes, because I'm not a fan of the winner of 1983, but that's a story for another time. But that is why Ole Ole is my song of the week. So while Israel may lie outside of the European continent, it is a part of the Eurovision family. It's highlighted the diversity of countries in the European Broadcasting Union and shows that Eurovision isn't just for Europe. It's for a wider audience surrounding both the continent of Europe and its neighbors across the Mediterranean. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Next week, we're going to get to know one of the hosts of the Eurovision Song Contest, so stay tuned to see which host we'll be discussing. If you'd like to get in touch with us to send us your comments, your thoughts, your ideas, you can do so on Instagram. We are at ESC101podcast. You can also send us an email, ESC101podcast@gmail.com. You can check out our show notes on our website, www.esc101podcast.wordpress.com, where you can check out links to articles and sources and photos and all that sort of good stuff. And be sure to leave us a review on whichever podcast platform you're currently listening to. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes. And with that, thank you so much for listening. Your support means a lot to me, so thank you. You have been listening to ESC 101. See you next time.